This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
While tea is being served, would you like to hear a story? I see some of the warm jewel Sangha from Santa Cruz has come by. So some of you have not heard this story. Some of you heard it this morning. There was once upon a time in old China a Dharma teacher named Du Shan. And Du Shan heard about this new phenomena called Zen happening down in the south. And he said that his understanding was that it takes eons of learning and study, and then further eons of practice to be a Buddha. These Zen people in the south, I heard that they say things like, you can just point directly to mind, realize your true nature, and be Buddha right now. And when he heard about that, he said, I'll take care of him. I'll go south and exterminate that vermin and repay the kindness of the Buddhas by trying to stop these heretics of Zen. And on his way south, he started getting hungry on the road and happened to be an old woman selling these things. Mochi. Rice cakes. I don't know if you call these dim sum. Would anybody call these dim sum? There are sweet dim sum, right? Oh yeah, I think. Jordan, would you ever call these dim sum?
Typically not. Oh, well, yes. Yeah.
Thank you.
I think I would call them dim sum. Dim sum is a Cantonese term.
Oh, okay.
And it refers
these are Japanese.
To a type of dining, but dim sum, I would call it dim
sum. Okay, so even better.
Because he's a northerner.
That's right. Cantonese, we say dim sum means, literally means to refresh the mind. And in Mandarin, you pronounce it Tianjin.
Yes.
Or Japanese, Tenjin. They have various names, but it's like rice flour with something stuffed in the middle. And so naturally, when he saw a woman selling these, he said, what do you do? And she said, I sell Tianqin, dim sum. I sell mind refreshers. They probably look just like these. And he said, I would like to refresh my mind with one of your mind refreshers. And she said, what's that in your backpack? And he said, its commentaries on the Diamond Sutra. Don't you know? I'm like Diamond King Zhao, the famous Diamond Sutra commentator. And the old woman said, well, can I ask you something? And he said, sure, you can ask anything. And she said, I heard it said that in the Diamond Sutra that past mind is ungraspable, present mind is ungraspable, and future mind is ungraspable. Which of these minds would you like to refresh with this mind refresher, Tianqin, with this mind refreshment? And Dushan was speechless. He didn't know what to say. All his Diamond Sutra commentaries didn't help him at this time. And
he needed a rice cake.
He was hungry, yeah.
And he couldn't think, you know.
Maybe he had low blood sugar. And it was a hot day. Could have been the problem. But since he couldn't express himself, the old woman shook out her sleeves and left. Dogen says that after Dushan went down to meet Long Tan and who he was going to try to refute, and was actually converted to Zen in the process, then he was able to say that a painted rice cake doesn't satisfy hunger. And he didn't need all the sutra commentaries in his backpack anymore. And then Dogen now says, reflecting on this story, it's clear that Dushan had not clarified the matter. Even later, after meeting his Zen teacher, Long Tan, he must have feared that old woman. She's a scary one. Yeah? He was an immature student and not an old Buddha going beyond realization. And Dogen goes on, although the old woman shut him up, shut his mouth, we cannot say whether she was a person of true understanding. Dogen doesn't want to leave anything unquestioned. It's possible that she had heard of ungraspable mind and asked this question, thinking that mind is ineffable. Or another translation is, thinking that mind is non-existent.
It's not.
Not existent. So maybe you could understand this as she'd heard about ungraspable mind, but then there's nothing to say. I'll ask him this question, and how can he say anything about ungraspable mind, because there isn't anything there at all. And also, ineffable means it can't be spoken of. It's unspeakable. So I'm going to ask him this question about the unspeakable. And he's into speaking. He's got all these sutra commentaries. And so let's see what he does when I ask him about the non-existent, the unspeakable. But it sounds like Dogen is saying, is kind of critical of thinking that ungraspable mind is ineffable and non-existent. It sounds like it's possible that she had heard of this ungraspable mind and only thought that the mind doesn't exist or that the mind can't be spoken of at all. Kind of sounds like Dogen saying, it can be expressed. Dogen's trying to express it all the time. If Dushan had been fully awakened, he would have been able to respond and discern whether or not the old woman was a person of the way, a person of true understanding. But since Dushan was not yet Dushan, we do not know or see through the old woman's understanding. So they could have had a little more dialogue. If Dushan was clearer, he could have asked her some questions back too. But he wasn't able to say anything. Dogen says, since Dushan was not yet Dushan, meaning like he wasn't yet totally clear. That's a nice phrase. Since Dushan was not yet really Dushan. So Dogen has another essay called The Ancient Mirror. And in this writing, Dogen says, talking about a different Zen teacher, Matsu, but he says that at the moment when that person, Matsu, but here we could apply it to Dushan, at the moment when that person becomes Buddha, that person becomes that person. At the moment that person becomes that person, Zazen becomes Zazen. At the moment you become Buddha, you become you. You might think it would be the other way around, like the moment you become Buddha, then you're no longer you. But it's like now you're really you. You're completely you. There's nothing blocking you from you. At the moment you become Buddha, you really become yourself. At the moment you become yourself, Zazen becomes Zazen. It's a nice passage in the Ancient Mirror. But since Dushan was not yet Dushan, we don't know or see through the old woman's understanding. We don't get to hear about her understanding because Dushan didn't ask her and it's too late. We can't ask her because she already walked away. I hear that Suzuki Roshi used to say, Zazen is just being yourself. Which sounds kind of funny at first, I think, of like, well, I'm just a silly, confused, clumsy boy, and I just Zazen is and confused and obsessed and thinking all the time. Just be like that, and that's Zazen. It's being yourself, right? It could sound like that's strange, but it may be that. When we open more and more to our true nature as ungraspable mind that can't be grasped as existent or non-existent, that can't be grasped as appearing or disappearing, that can't be grasped as abiding in any location, and yet that ungraspable mind that's expressing itself as everything that we do, raising our eyebrows and blinking and having a cup of tea. And then when we're in touch with that, then it's like everything we're doing is an expression of our true nature. It always really is, but when we're in touch with that, then we're okay, however we're appearing like that. So maybe that's what Suzuki Roshi meant by just being yourself. You could say being your true self of ungraspable mind, but even being your clumsy, confused self that's an expression of that, being okay with that because you know the true nature of clumsiness. You know the true nature of confusion. Dogen goes on, those who nowadays, actually it literally says, those presently abiding in Great Song Dynasty China, so he's talking about these Chinese Zen people who wear cloud robes and mist sleeves, or cloud patches and mist sleeves. It's a poetic way of talking about Zen monks. Those who laugh at Dushan for being unable to respond and praise the old woman for her brilliance are foolish. It's too one-sided. It's too simple to just let it go. That. Right? That she's so brilliant. I think she was pretty sharp to ask this Diamond Sutra commentator this question from the Diamond Sutra. But they could have deepened their dialogue further. So we may doubt the old woman's understanding because when Dushan could not answer, she could have said, "Reverend, you cannot answer my question. Ask me the same question and I'll give you an answer." Which is a thing that you see happen in a lot of the old Zen stories. Often a Zen teacher will ask a question to the assembly and no one will answer. And then he'll say, "Well, now you ask me the same question," just so he can demonstrate the answer. So I think it's kind of a Zen way to bring out the Dharma that was, and Dogen saying, she could have done that. She could have said, "You can't answer, so why don't you ask me the question and I'll answer for you?" Because then we get to hear her answer. If she then could have answered Dushan, it would have been clear that she was truly a person of realization. Asking a question is not yet making a statement. So she was good at asking a great question, but she didn't yet express herself with a statement. There has never been a case since olden times where someone who said nothing was regarded as a person of realization. We talked about this morning, that important part of Zen, in addition to just sitting, and in addition to conversing with teachers and Sangha to bring out the Dharma and clarify understanding, this third important aspect of Zen is to then be able to express something. There's never been a case since olden times where someone who said nothing was regarded as a person of realization. This is a book by Katagiri Roshi called "You Have to Say Something." Groundless self-proclamations are useless, just as in the case of Dushan, or vain self-boasting is useless, just as in the case of Dushan, who boasted about being such a great scholar of the Diamond Sutra. And those who have not made a right statement should not be accepted, just as in the case of the old woman. So he's saying Dushan was just made vain boasts that's useless, but also not making some statement or expression to convey the Dharma is also not right, like the old woman. So he's kind of critical of both. Try to speak for Dushan, Dogen says. Try to speak for him, since he couldn't speak. He's kind of asking us, right? When asked by the old woman, he should have said, now this is where he gets into the, Dogen's now kind of trying to rewrite the whole dialogue and say, this is how it should have gone. And I think this is somewhat unique to this essay, to give all these alternate responses of Dogen's, like, kind of like, if I were there, I would have said that if I was him, and if I was her, I would have said this. And so these are the kind of, I think it's kind of funny though, he says, he should have said, like, this is what he should have said. If so, then don't sell me rice cakes. You know, she said, if you can, which mind is of these past, present, and future ungraspable minds, which one will you refresh with this mind refresher? And if you can say something, I'll give you some. And if you can't, I won't. So then Dushan could have said, well, then don't sell me any. Could have at least said that. That would have been pretty simple, right? If he had done so, Dogen says, it would have been a sharp investigation of the way. Wow, it's kind of simple. Doesn't take that much to say, well, then just don't sell me any. Dushan may ask the old woman, you know, when she asks him this question, he may, or you could say, he should have asked her back. He may have asked her this. Past mind is ungraspable. Present mind is ungraspable. Future mind is ungraspable. With which mind will you satisfy your hunger with these cakes? So this translation just repeats back the exact same question that she asked him. But which is another one of the kind of Zen methods that you see in these koans, is somebody asks a question and the other one just repeats the same question back. But another translation of that is, with which mind will you satisfy your customer's hunger with these cakes? Maybe there's not really a you or a customer's, but it's more like, with which mind will be refreshed by these mind refreshers, by these dim sum. And so not like she could have, it's not like she was about to have the cakes herself. He could have just said, well, which mind is refreshed by these mind refreshers? So those are some statements Dushan could have made according to Dogen. But there's many possibilities. It's not like that's the definitive thing he should have said. So I came up with some myself. This is what I think he should have said. When she said, past mind cannot be grasped, present mind cannot be grasped, future mind cannot be grasped, with which of these minds will you refresh with this mind refresher? Which will you satisfy with this mind satisfier? Which of these sums will you dim with this dim sum? And he should have said, the mind temporarily called Dushan will be refreshed by these cakes. Or he should have said, I am always intimate with this. Or he should have said, past, present, and future mind are ungraspable. Which mind wants an answer to your question? Or he should have said, ungraspable mind will be refreshed with these mind refreshers. Or really, he should have said, a painted cake doesn't satisfy hunger. Sell me the real thing. Yes.
When it's just simply been this present mind that sells. I mean, there's only a present mind. So if you give it a rice cake, it is a present mind, right?
A present mind is ungraspable.
Yeah, it's ungraspable, but it's still present.
Ah, that's right. That's what Dushan should have said. Thank you.
Doesn't Dogen say, like, Jim Sum's mind will be refreshed?
Yeah, later is another part of this. Yeah, later he'll say that, yeah. But really, Dushan should have said, I will have your cake and eat it too. Yes?
How did the story come to us? Either the woman or he had to talk about it.
Good question. Yeah, was there a secret bystander on the road that heard this? Maybe he was. Maybe if it's a true story, then maybe that's what happened if there was nobody else. Or maybe the old woman wrote it down and slipped it under the door of a Zen temple somewhere.
Yeah. He said that when he said a painted rice cake doesn't satisfy hunger, that it was sometime later, right after...
After he met the Zen teacher, right? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So it could well be that Dushan humbly did tell the story afterwards, right? Yeah,
I
totally.
I assume that the lady selling the rice cakes was a student of long time. So
could be. Could be that she was on the road, but nearby, right? Just down the road. She was the entrance to the driveway.
Dushan. To teach long time a lesson. In her
yes,
sister.
That's right.
She met her on the road, and she was a student of long time.
So could be. It didn't say that, but
yeah, no,
could be. Totally could be. Seemed like she was kind of had a kind of Zen spirit, mm-hmm. right? So she might have told Long Tan right later. So
Long Tan sent her.
Ah! With his big mind, he could see one of those scholars from the north is going to try to make another vain attempt to try to refute the Southern School of Zen, but. I'll send out my best student, the rice cake lady. Yeah. So that's what Dushan should have said. Then, when that happens, when he should have said that, then the old woman should say, according to Dogen, Reverend, you only know that rice cakes, here it says satisfy your hunger, but actually in the Japanese it's a negative. It says, you only know that rice cakes don't satisfy mind. Remember, it's dim sum. You only know that the rice cakes don't refresh the mind, is really what it says. You don't know that mind... Here it says, mind satisfies the rice cake's hunger. Really, there's no word hunger in here. Or that mind satisfies the mind's hunger. You could say it like that, Kaz Ta-Nehisi says. But some other translations are, you don't know that mind refreshes cake or that mind refreshes mind. You only know that cake doesn't refresh mind, you don't know that mind refreshes cake, or that mind refreshes mind. So, Dogen often talks this way, but, you know, reversing all different types of sentences. But we could look into, you know, what he's pointing at here. That, again, if ungraspable mind is the boundless space outside of which is nothing, and outside of which is nothing, so if there's anything appearing, it must be within this boundless space. If it has no boundaries, there's nothing outside it. That means all of this must be within this ungraspable mind. And therefore, within this ungraspable mind is things like cake, and not to mention everything else. So there's like cake refreshes mind is a way of looking at these two dimensions of, again, the conventional appearances appearing within the ungraspable mind, and then the ultimate ungraspability of the space, the aware space in which it's all appearing. So you could say appearances within the space of awareness kind of refresh the appearance. They refresh the space. In a way, the space of awareness never changes. It's by definition, it is fresh. It's very fresh, the space. In a sense, it never gets stale. It never gets old. It's always vividly now, right? The space of ungraspable mind, and the things that appear within it, even though it's already always fresh, these things like freshen it. A little bit like Jeff was saying the other day, something about like when we're practicing this way, our ordinary experiences start to seem more kind of vivid and delightful, something like that. So like eating a rice cake, you know, as we're more and more resting in the spaciousness of ungraspable mind, eating a rice cake is even more refreshing. It's not exactly that the rice cake refreshes the mind, because the nature of mind is inherently fresh. But it's maybe kind of feels that way. But maybe we could say, from this point of view of this mind can't really be refreshed, then we go with this negative that the text actually has. You only know that rice cakes don't really refresh the mind. In other words, you're really into the Diamond Sutra. I know that, which means you have this whole pack of words on your back all about emptiness. That's what the Diamond Sutra is all about, is that there's nothing but empty space. That's all there is. Just like the Heart Sutra says, there is no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, and no rice cakes. Right? So you only know that rice cakes don't refresh the empty space of mind, because nothing touches it. You could hear it like that. I know you know that. But you don't yet know that mind refreshes cake. You're really into emptiness. You get that cake doesn't really change emptiness. But you maybe don't appreciate so much how emptiness makes the cake really delicious. Maybe you could hear it like that.
Emptiness is form.
Yes, emptiness. Yeah, you're really into form as emptiness. But you might not be so into that emptiness is form. Exactly. that part of the Heart Sutra strikes me when we're having these discussions, when we chanted it this morning, I thought, the Heart Sutra is just the best. My heart is really open to that. The Heart Sutra is in my heart. And because as we have been speaking of the ungraspable mind, we could interpret the Heart Sutra in, from the point of view of our discussion as emptiness means this ungraspable mind, like the unchanging screen on which the movie is playing, and form is like the movie playing on the screen. So from that point of view, form, the movie itself, is the empty screen, and the empty screen itself is the display of the movie. So it makes that line of the Heart Sutra kind of accessible in an experiential kind of way, I think. It's not so philosophical. It's like we can taste a little of that, right? And also in the Heart Sutra, in emptiness, given emptiness, in emptiness, all dharmas are marked by emptiness. They neither arise nor cease. All dharmas have the characteristic or the quality of emptiness. So everything in the movie has the quality of the screen. Everything in the movie is marked by the screen. And therefore, the movie characters that are standing up and sitting down and standing up and sitting down, they actually don't arise and cease. Right? They appear to arise and cease. They appear to be constantly changing, but their true nature is the screen on which they're playing. Their true nature is the knowing of them, and the knowing of arising and ceasing doesn't arise and cease. Right? You can see the Heart Sutra through this lens.
Also, isn't there's a longer form, the Heart Sutra, where it spells out all the skand five, right?
It's in the Heart Sutra.
Instead of just saying these and these are like this as well. So it will say sensation is emptiness, emptiness is sensation. Not just formation.
Okay,
right?
Yeah.
So it lists all, mm-hmm. I've heard versions of it where it has it all kind of broken out.
Uh-huh.
So kind of like summed up.
Well, that's a great reflection, a great meditation to not form.
It's not just form, it's all of them.
Yes.
All of the skandhas are also emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
Emptiness is all of them.
Yeah, form in the short Heart Sutra, it's just form stands for all of them. And in a way, maybe they choose form partly because it's the first skanda, but also because it makes the most radical statement that, like, you know, material form itself is emptiness. It's maybe easier to open to feelings are emptiness, and emptiness is feeling, but form itself is emptiness. The body is emptiness. But I think it's a great meditation to actually take up each of the five skandhas and insert them in that sentence. Because sometimes we're actually most caught up in like feelings, but feelings are emptiness, and emptiness is expressing itself as feelings. Yeah. Consciousness, so this is that fifth skandha, is, as we've been talking about, dualistic consciousness is emptiness. But emptiness, you could say that non-dual awareness of emptiness appears as dualistic consciousness. So Dogen says that the old woman should have said, you don't know that mind refreshes the cake. Ungraspable mind vivifies forms like the cake. Or that mind refreshes mind. It's really like what's most clearly we can express that there's nothing but mind refreshing mind. If she says that, then Dushan will try to find an answer or reply to that. At that moment, she should pick up 3 pieces of rice cake and offer them to Dushan. When Dushan moves to receive them, the old woman should say, past mind is ungraspable, present mind is ungraspable, future mind is ungraspable. That's why that's where she's offering 3, one for each of those minds, right? And when he's about to grasp them, she'll say, these 3 minds are ungraspable. Again, Dogen says, Dushan may open his hand to receive the rice cakes. Like, so she should, he's gonna get the rice cakes now. He's getting really hungry and starting to get delirious out in the hot summer sun, and his blood sugar is dropping quick. Just like, can we finish the Zen dialogue and have some cake? And but as he moves to receive them, she just say, the past mind is ungraspable, present mind is ungraspable, future mind is ungraspable. Then when he actually opens his hands to receive them, she should pick one of the rice cakes up and hit Dushan with it and say, a corpse with no spirit, don't be dumbfounded. Maybe he's like, just give me that. And like, say something. Don't hesitate. If Dushan speaks upon hearing these words, it will be good. If not, the old woman should continue to say more. Merely flapping her sleeves and going away are not like holding a stinging bee inside the sleeves. And the translator put in parentheses, is not sharp enough. So I guess this may be some old Chinese phrase for holding a stinging bee inside the sleeves. It's like, it's a very kind of dangerous and alert kind of situation, and sharp. We have to be very careful when there's a bee in our sleeve, right? And by just walking away, it's not like she's holding a stinging bee. And I don't know, inside her sleeve or inside his sleeve. She's not sharp enough to just walk away. So, I say, Kokyo says, the old woman should have said at this point, since ungraspable mind is always refreshed, please have this mind refreshing cake as a gift. Dushan did not say to the old woman, I cannot answer, please speak for me. Which sometimes they do in the Zen stories. I mean, he wasn't quite humble enough to say, I don't know, you tell me. Thus he did not say what he was supposed to say and did not ask what he was supposed to ask. So I heard... Did anybody here practice with Kobin? Oh, yeah, Corrine, of course. Oh, you did too. My friend Satya, she's a good friend of mine who is ordained by Kobin Chino Roshi, and I think that, and practiced with him at Jikoji, and I heard that sometimes, and I don't know how often, this might have been like a one-time thing, but he said, at least when he was there with Kobin, they were talking about Zen koans, and Kobin wanted to act them out, kind of like have people play the parts and act them out for the group, and kind of see what happens. Maybe there would be different responses. Did you ever hear Kobin?
No, I didn't.
Did you ever hear? So maybe it was a rare thing, but. And sometimes with my teacher, Tenshin Roshi, at Green Gulch, we would also, in koan discussions, kind of play out the scenario, especially if it's a complicated one. It's nice to see 2 people doing it. So especially since this story is so much about what they each should have said differently, and there's all these different possibilities. There's no right or wrong. There's infinite possibilities of what both of them could have said, Dushan and the old woman. I thought we could try acting out some. So I got to say some of my responses, what they should have said. But you can...
some rice cakes.
some of you can then offer. So if you're up for this, in the Jikoji tradition, we could try it out. It means that we could try it with different groups of people, but so there's Dushan and the old woman, but gender doesn't matter. You could play either one. And maybe we could set it up so that we're not following this dialogue, but we can set up the beginning scenario to see what happens. So we could say that Dushan is Dushan with his Diamond Sutra commentaries on his way south to exterminate Zen. Someone could play this character, and the other could play the old woman that he meets selling rice cakes. And we have some rice cakes. Are there any more left?
No.
Okay. Well, we can we can just pretend. And then we can just have them. And Dushan is hungry. Let's say that's the setup scenario. He'd like to have some rice cakes, and she would like to sell some, and also to have some Zen dialogue. But we can leave it there and kind of take it from there, right? Instead of their conversation. So either one could kind of start the conversation, and we could just see various different scenarios of how it should have gone. Is anybody up for it? Would anybody like to play one of these parts? Try it out. There's no right or wrong answers. And especially because we're just having an encounter and it's not about you. It's you know, one of you is Dushan and one of you is the rice cake seller. So, great. Which would you like to be?
You choose.
Well, any others? We need another Tavada. Great. How about maybe be nice to like come forward. This is the road here. Which would you like to be, sir?
Whoever he's offering.
Neither one of you cares.
I'll be Dushan.
Okay.
Who's gonna be the rice cake?
Do we even have a painted rice cake?
There's a half of one, but I better eat it quick before it gets sold. So, you're hot and sweaty.
Hi. What you got there?
Well, hi there. I've got some delicious rice cakes.
Those look pretty good. Hey, I could use one of those. May I have one? Would you sell me one?
Well, what's that on your back?
This old thing? This big pack full of...
Yeah.
Oh, man, it's full of sutras. It's full of commentaries on the Diamond Sutra. Don't you just love the Diamond Sutra? I love the Diamond Sutra. I know everything about the Diamond Sutra.
Oh, well, can you answer a question?
I guess so.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, I don't know. Can you tell me, okay, if I give you one of these rice cakes...
Yeah.
I have heard that the Diamond Sutra says that the past mind is ungraspable, the present mind is ungraspable, and the future mind is ungraspable.
Quite right.
Tell me, sir, with which mind will you satisfy if I give you one of these rice cakes?
Which mind will I satisfy if you give me one of the rice cakes? None of those will satisfy me. I want three of them.
There's the one.
Thanks. For free?
Of course.
That's right. That's what they should have said. Anybody else want to try it out? Or is that cover it?
I have a question.
Yes.
If mind is ungraspable, how does the interplay now educate us or help us advance, since any answer could be neither good nor bad?
Yeah, it's not like there's a right or wrong answer, but maybe we could say some ways of expressing things can be more, can turn the mind in a new way. And I think that's like some of the skill of different types of responses is none are necessarily wrong, but some are really like, I think a lot of the stories that get recorded are like ones where it's like, oh, that really refreshes my mind. That really like gouges out the traps and snares, something like that. Yeah, doesn't it feel that way when some of these Zen stories, when some of the answers are like they're not what we expect.
One of the really difficult parts in this, for Doshan, is when he's proclaimed so vigorously that he is king of the sutra, your ego is just there.
Yeah.
And to go into Dharma combat with it there, there isn't a response maybe that ego can give.
Mm.
And so... Unless he were able to quickly reflect and say, I don't know.
No, I think you're exactly right. I think that was maybe why he couldn't answer. And also, I think it's a great point, because he has this reputation. This is another part of, like, he's kind of famous Diamond Sutra commentator. And because he has this reputation, he feels like I have to give the right answer, and there's this pressure to be right and to maintain the good reputation, right? So if he was just like the rice cake seller woman, she's more free because she doesn't have this kind of like Zen reputation.
No rank.
What's that?
No rank.
Yeah, no rank. Yeah. So he's not so worried about getting it wrong. Whereas if you have the reputation, then you maybe get worried about, like, what if I get it wrong? Because this story is going to be recorded, and they're going to read it in America, like, in hundreds of years. Like, stakes are high. Yes?
I have a question.
Yes.
So in the way that mind refreshes cake, when one looks back on an experience with new eyes, sees it in a different light, can you say mind is refreshing experience?
Like refreshing, making it like new and vivid. So you could say, yeah, mind is refreshing some old cake. It's kind of making the old, you know, we all have some stale molding cake in our storehouse, right? In our cupboard, in our dark cupboard from the past, we have some molding cake, right? And you could say mind, ungraspable mind, can refresh the old cake, the old moldy cake, which is like our stories about past events, painful past events. Because past mind, as we talked about, really cannot be grasped because it doesn't exist at all. And future mind cannot be grasped because it really doesn't exist at all. Present mind seems like the possibility that it might exist, But first we can put those past and future ones aside and say any experience of the past or the future is always happening in the present mind. And then we can start to see how that too is ungraspable. And seeing how the present mind is ungraspable refreshes the molding cakes from the past. Yeah, it's new cake. It's always new. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that really, we talked about yesterday that about the timelessness of ungraspable mind. The dimensionlessness, but also the timelessness, and how dimension or spatiality and time or temporality appear within ungraspable mind rather than the other way around. So in that way, the past is not really past. Therefore, since it's happening now, whatever moldy cake is coming up in our experience that we remember, something like that, it's always now. So therefore, there's so much possibility. Now is infinitely, has infinite potential to be anything. Now that we call ungraspable mind is able to express itself as anything, actually. So we say, but it keeps expressing itself as this moldy old cake. But it doesn't have to. In a way, you could say it keeps doing that because of our karma. It feels like we're bound by that karma. But the more and more we open to the all-inclusive spaciousness of ungraspable mind, it seems like the flexibility becomes more and more apparent. Our stuck karmic patterns don't have to be that way. It may be that they keep repeating like that, but they don't have to be.
Free.
Yeah.
Free the experience.
Yeah, we're freeing the actual experiences into the expanse of the experiencing awareness. Or you could say the experiencing, which we've been talking about as another name for this ungraspable mind of awareness. This experiencing is what enables all experiences to be freed. Yeah. Yes?
Yeah, I like that question because that reminds me of my question yesterday. Of course, that's why I like it. But you know, that I was bringing in the live feed and the recorded feed.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
To the movie screen.
Yeah.
And for some reason, the recorded feed doesn't seem quite as, what's the word you said I used yesterday? Fresh. Thank you. But not quite as alive.
Yeah.
Have that experience as we sit. I'm feeling a little bit more alive, a little more refreshed. Just like what you're speaking about. But it seems like if we have the ability to put, like, we put the DVR on the had equal footing with the live stream, the DVR, the recorded stream, would have just as much potency to us as the live stream. But it doesn't seem that that's the case.
Maybe it doesn't seem, I think you're right, it doesn't seem like that's the case. Maybe because we're just assuming that the recorded feed is an old stale thing. We're not appreciating how it actually is happening now. And maybe if that old memory, it kind of maybe annoying memory that keeps coming up again and again, maybe if we really open to how that really is happening on the same screen, it really is fresh, then its moldy quality starts to be more vivid and less moldy.
Well, there's another explanation why he was unable to answer. Maybe he thought the old lady was his mom. and he got confused, and he couldn't, he didn't want to, that happens to people all the time. They get confused about what their past affects what they see in the present.
Definitely he could have thought or his grandma.
It doesn't seem as real, and he's confused, and that's like, like I was saying yesterday, one of the reasons why I sit, that helps, we talk about clarifying the mind, that disentangles, so that he sees that old woman as an old woman, and the mom's not there at all. I mean, there's some kind of process that's occurring like that, at least in my, that's how I experience. Thank you, I'm having a lot of help.
So, my mind You see how mind refreshes cake.
Well, I see mind refreshes cake.
When you're present.
Appreciate that we're aware of your awareness. It makes things fresh and fresh, and I can use that as a signal or as a telltale that. Oh, I think that's what the freshness and more clarity, more aliveness, maybe that's what that is. Hmm. But it seems like things that are stale don't have that same mark. Hmm. That's sort of what I'm, that's sort of like the DVR thing. It's like, somehow when I'm sitting, I've learned to see the difference between what's alive and what's not alive.
Yeah. And then maybe we can keep trying to expand our inclusiveness to include the stale stuff more and more. Also, once we get used to the difference that you're talking about, the fresh stuff, then we can start saying, rather than just saying, let's just forget about the stale stuff, we can maybe start opening to, let's see how we can be vividly fresh with the stale too. It's possible, but that's like another practice we could do, just so we include everything. Well, this is like what we were talking, like some old memory, right? That feels like, or old habit pattern. Like an old habit that I keep getting stuck in, this old habit, and then I feel like, did I do it again? I just like for me, I have a habit pattern of being late a lot, right? So I don't like it so much, this pattern, but it's like it's been going on for like many years, and
decades,
and so and so when it comes up, I'm like. Sometimes I feel like, and I'm kind of moving quick to get somewhere, I'm like, here it is again. And it's like, maybe some self-judgment or something. That's what I would mean by stale, not fresh. There's that old thing again. Why can't I get over it? That's like, rather than that, can I relate to it? Like, amazing. A human being can be late to something. And this is like, this today being late is unlike any other time I've ever been late. Like that, like this is like a fresh being late, and therefore there's wonderment and awe, rather than like this again. Like wow, it's so fresh to be moving so quickly.
So amazing.
Amazing.
I mean, we laugh, but it's true. Every time you're like you or any one of us are late, it's a unique condition.
Yeah, yeah.
Causing you to be late, even though it is. In your perception that it's the same pattern, right? Like you might just think that it's
exactly.
The same thing. It's just like the last
time,
but it's different.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not actually the same.
It's not the same, yeah.
It's all behavior. It's just not changing it, but you're giving it a different name, but it's still the old same old thing. It's probably not like calling it by your type. Rename it doesn't change the fact that it's an old behavior.
It's old, but it's happening. Right now. It's a unique expression, but there's a pattern, we might say, but it's happening on the screen, which is always now. And this is like, from the point of view of the screen, it's not an old pattern. Maybe that's the point, right? But from the point of view of the movie, it's like, this is just a rerun. What is it called? DVR. Yeah. Like, yeah, it's old reruns of bad TV shows. It's kind of like change the channel, but the screen doesn't ever say change the channel. The TV screen is like, fine, whatever show you play is fresh.
Analysis afterwards, where you say, "Oh, I was late the same way I was before."
No.
But
I'm talking about in the present.
Happens. People think it's real. Like if you think someone's your mother and you're not aware that you think that they're your mother or influenced that way, you're not, you think that's real and it's very alive in that certain way.
Yeah, so here we're talking about let's not think that it's real. And you could say, well, we are going to. And I'm saying, how about trying on this other way? And we'll, of course, we will fail. We'll all fail at this. Keep thinking that it's that the movie is real. But if we keep settling into the screen, then and remembering what's real and what's not real.
There's something about settling into the screen that the artifacts of our mind drop away.
Artifacts.
The artifacts of our small minds, yeah. So there's something. There's something about that.
They maybe drop away.
Or trying to capture something.
Yes.
So are empty and ungraspable the same thing?
Yeah. I think that's a great question, and I think there's all these Buddhist terms, but I would say yes. That's in fact when emptiness is an accurate translation of the term shunyata, but it's more when we're just talking about it to people who've never heard all the stuff about Prajnaparamita and stuff. I think it's kind of a vague term. It's hard to understand. So I like to use the word, when I like to think, how can I make this term emptiness accessible to people? I like to use that word, ungraspable. I think it's a great one. It's not a literal translation, but I think it gets at the meaning more than many other terms. Yeah.
Boundless.
Boundless is another one, yeah. Which, interesting that those two terms, which I think both get at aspects of emptiness, sound quite different, right? The meaning of ungraspable and the meaning of boundless are two different, they're not synonyms, right? And yet, they both get at emptiness very nicely. Emptiness, there's many ways of talking about emptiness. It's boundless means it has no boundaries or reference points, we sometimes say. But also, it's related to ungraspable, but they're a little different. So yeah, both those words are good. And emptiness, it means that it's empty, or another way to say it is, empty of what? And then we can say, it's empty of graspability. Yes?
So I'm glad you asked the question, because that was the question similar to what I was going to ask, because my confusion is on the word ungraspable. And so I don't know if I'm confused because I'm being too philosophical, but because when I hear that word, I wonder right away, well, what is considered graspable?
yeah.
How can we use that word? Mm-hmm.
Also, notice that these words that we're talking about, the ultimate here, are almost all negative words, right? Boundless and ungraspable and emptiness, right?
So what is bound? What is graspable? Like, rice cake, I'm kind of confused about that now.
No, this is a great question.
Is that graspable?
Yeah. So when we're saying ungraspable, the teaching of emptiness is that nothing is actually graspable. But why they use this word is because we think and feel as if things are graspable. Things, and mostly we're talking about mental things, like thoughts seem to be graspable, feelings seem to be graspable. And grasping is a word we just use a lot. It means like, I think it's a nice word because grasp, we usually feel this, like a physical hand is how we, if I hear the word grasp.
I feel attachment.
Yeah, same.
I feel that it's only like for just a little bit, because I had that.
Clinging.
I had two. But now it's gone, you know what I'm saying? So where was that grasp, and what part of that experience
Really?
Was it when I was physically holding it? Like, is that the part that's graspable?
Well, as I said, you weren't here yesterday, I think, right?
It wasn't.
Yeah. Yesterday I was saying that as soon as mind arises in this, in what we call consciousness, dualistic consciousness, where there's apparently an object, a subject, like a mind, aware of an object outside of itself, which is how we, our sense consciousnesses are like that, where it seems like there's somebody over here seeing you over there, and it seems like there's a sound of a car on the road out there, and with the mind, it's like our thoughts seem to be objects of mind. They seem to be somehow separate from the knowing of them. That's all that's called dualistic consciousness. And as soon as there's that sense of duality, the teaching will say that's an illusion. But when that illusion of duality arises, there's automatically what we call grasping. It's almost the same thing. As soon as you have a subject and an object, there's no way to have a subject and an object without grasping. This is the most subtle version of grasping that we're talking about. It's not like, well, let's have a subject and an object, but just not grasp the object. It's the Buddhist thing will say, like, if I see you over there, that's what we call grasping.
Okay.
Yeah, not like I'm getting a hold of you, but just to see you and to think that you are separate from awareness is called grasping. Does that make sense?
I think so. Can I put it in my terms just mm-hmm. so I can make sure? Because what it sounds like you're saying is that it's within my personal experience that we call it grasping. Because at some point, maybe, you know, I become fully realized that happens. Right? And I'm not grasping. So is that what you're saying? That I can exist? I mean, there's this existence happening, but in my existence that's happening right now, I'm grasping because I perceive a subject and object.
Yeah, you perceive a subject and object. And you might want...
It disappears once it melts, whatever that experience is like, because I don't really know. Then I'm no longer grasping.
That's right, that's okay. Right. That's right. And then we might say, but if that happens, that means we couldn't see or hear anymore. It would be like being dead, we might think, right? Because if I can see something and hear something, that's automatically grasping. We might wonder, how could there be a Buddha that can walk and talk and speak, right?
Yeah, how do the senses,
yeah, how do the senses work? And like I said yesterday, according to these teachings, especially the Mahayana teachings, they say Buddhas, even the sense consciousnesses that are non-conceptual, they're direct seeing of sensory data. There's no concept. Even those are dualistic because there's this sense of a subject and an object, even without conceptuality. So I would say duality is more subtle than conceptuality. And we say, well, this is crazy. How could a Buddha then see anything, right? And but this is what we've been talking about, is it's maybe not that far-fetched. It's a shift of perspective. So it's say that, and it's all about this ungraspable mind. So if we start to take this backward step and settle into awareness itself, and then we start to, as awareness, we start to explore ourselves as awareness and look for example, a boundary or edge of awareness and not find the boundary or edge, that means now we're discovering, can even experientially discover the boundlessness of awareness, meaning like there seems to be boundaries or edges or location, but actually awareness is not one of these things that has location or edges or boundaries. The more we start to open that, then if we can conclude that awareness has no boundaries, again, that means no boundaries means there's nothing outside of it. But I'm still seem to be seeing you, right? But now it's like if I can stay with this and see you as you are not outside of awareness. It's not like awareness is going out and grasping you. It's more like you are appearing within awareness, as awareness. I think the movie metaphor works very nicely here. you are now, instead of an actual entity separate from me, you're like, you are one with the screen of awareness. You are awareness expressing itself as what looks like a person. But there's no distance. Another way to say it, it seems usually that there's about 15 feet between me and you. And there is between this eyeball and you, there's about 15 feet. But I think that I'm behind the eyeball. Right? I identify with a located me in the head over here, 15 feet from your head. But if I shift that identity to like, I'm not located in the head, I am like unlocated awareness in which you and everything is appearing and sounds are appearing, then it's like the 15 feet thing is kind of an illusion. How far, if I am unlocated awareness, then how far away from me, unlocated awareness, are you? And we don't say 15 feet anymore, right? We say there's no distance. Literally, there's no distance. There is one of those negatives again. It comes in negatives. But then we say, well, then, is this totally non-existent if everything we say about it is negative? We say, but no, it's not non-existent. It's not non-existent because we're having a conversation and I see you.
Okay, because now it sounds like I'm starting to understand what the difference is between conventional truth and ultimate truth.
Yeah. What would you say?
Because conventionally, yes, you're 15 feet away from me. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, there is no distance.
Nice, exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a nice way to put the ultimate truth that even someone like Jeff wouldn't argue with. Some of my things he might, but to say that there's no distance, he probably wouldn't argue with that because it's a negative. We're not claiming that there is some oneness or something like that. We're just saying that there's no distance. It's a nice, safe way of talking about the ultimate. With the Heart Sutra, it's all negation, right? There is no eye, no ears, no nose. Nobody can say that you're positing some ultimate thing. It's just that we just say there's no distance. Yeah. So, yes.
So what changes when there's no distance?
Yeah, because it kind of like still functioning pretty similarly, right? In a way, it's not like. You could say it's not that big a change. It's almost like it's the same. This is, again, part of the paradoxical when we start talking about it. It's like nothing's really different, and yet it's completely different because it used to be 15 feet. But you could say practically speaking, what changes is if we really start relating, if we really start trusting the ultimate truth, of no distance, more than we trust the conventional truth of 15 feet. And that's a big one, because I think this is a gradual process. This doesn't happen immediately. This is like, we get these, what I was calling experiences, like a little glimpse of no distance, and that can confirm that maybe it really is actually like that all the time. But my habit is very strong to see 15 feet. But then we can gradually start trusting the no distance more and more. Right now, we basically we all pretty much trust conventional truth way more than ultimate truth, I would say. Even myself, like I operate from the trust in conventional truth more than ultimate truth. But occasionally in Zazen, might be able to actually trust ultimate truth more. And we can start like shifting our trust ratio. Maybe after a lot of practice like this, we can get to, maybe it's like 50-50. it's sounding sort of like divided black and white, but maybe experience is actually like this. It's like, do we trust ourselves more as this limited body and mind? If somebody starts screaming at me, I'm definitely going to like trust the limited separate body and mind. But in Zazen, maybe I can drop away that limited one and trust it even more. And then over time, if we can trust the ultimate more than the conventional, and also know that they're not, remember, the ultimate and conventional inseparable. They're not like two completely different things, but they're two different perspectives. And if we trust the ultimate, then I think the point of this is we really then do start relating to the world differently, right? If, like, things that I've, again, this morning talking about fulfillment, I feel like if as long as there's conventional truth of duality, it means there's something outside myself, there will always be a greater or lesser degree of lack, a sense of there's something outside myself that I need to fulfill myself, and there will always be at least some degree of fear. There's something outside myself that can destroy myself and that I will die. And and that we operate, our life is, we could even say, like, almost everything we do throughout the day is based on this sense of fear and lack. Like, I need something. We're trying to get something. But if we, what if we didn't have that sense of any sense of fear or lack? You know, I might say that would be bad. We'd walk in front of trains and stuff. But maybe not. The Buddha didn't.
So Meizu talked about the absolute. Sarah talked yesterday about how, you know, remembering that we have this common awareness with all beings might help others. So for a bodhisattva, what use is this?
But you just said some of it right there, right?
Yeah. So and you were just talking about a little bit about it.
That we share.
We trust. Mm-hmm. We trust in the absolute. But it's how do we bring this into our life, and this trust of no separation, we still have to have separation.
Well, we have to have the appearance of separation, you could say.
Well,
again, now we're talking conventional and ultimate, right?
Right.
Ultimately, no separation ever, there has never ever been any separation. Conventionally, I like the word appearance because we could say there's definitely the appearance. Even the Buddha can say, you can ask, how far away from you do I appear? And the Buddha could say 15 feet, because I know how dualistic consciousness works, but I don't believe that that's how it really is. So that's why it appears that way. And we operate in the world of appearances. We have to keep operating in the world of appearances. And but hopefully through the trusting the realm of sometimes talk about reality and appearance. If we trust this ultimate, this reality in a way more than the appearance, then we can keep living in the world of appearance. But our conduct will become kinder and more loving because we see we're not separate.
It's going to be vast.
Because
with that common awareness with all things, or that there is no really distance, then there's plenty of time, there's plenty
of space.
We don't have to hurry to get the rock.
That's right, yeah. Little things.
Just watch our breath. Mm-hmm. I like what Hogan says at the beginning of the work period. He says, when you're working, bring a sense of your breath, of paying attention to your breath, have the tongue on the roof of your mouth, and bring your attention to that and see if what you're doing is going any faster than that, and maybe you want to slow down. Isn't that kind of what you said? and so how to bring
it appears that way.
Contemplative, spacious mind to our everyday means a generous, approach to ourselves and to the world.
Yeah. And all of this, these are all like the effects of this understanding and this realization. And it's true that, maybe as Jim pointed out, he said, Kokyo seems to like keep talking in this way, and like, it sounds different from so many other Zen teachings I hear that are about, like, let's try to be present and kind, and here's the precepts and all this. And I said something like, I do talk about that stuff sometimes, but I also feel like it's being covered very nicely, right? So that this is like a, this is, if it wasn't, then maybe I would talk about it more. But this is kind of like, instead of, I think both ways work. We would be present, take care of our, follow our breath during work, all these practices that help us be more present and grounded, and then we start to open to this space. And I'm more like just offering sort of the other way around, kind of like, let's open to the space. I'm emphasizing that, and then from that, then we're actually notice our breath more and we're more kind. So it's kind of maybe old style Zen to kind of start with the ultimate and then see how that plays out in the relative. But it's early Buddhism is starts with the relative for several eons and ends with the ultimate.
What's interesting to me, because I think last year you also talked similarly too. What's really interesting to me, because sometimes when we use from the approach from a dualistic point of view, sometimes you get frustrated and then you don't know what to do. And the kind of things that you're talking about, for me at least, the way I see it, is kind of equalizing, because it's not dependent on these conventional wisdom. So there's less, if you can get at it accurately, there's less chance that you slip into the dualistic kind of battle. I don't know if that makes any sense.
And also, it gives a lot of space for each person's life to play itself out uniquely,
yeah.
Right? So maybe we could talk about like, we should go ahead and like, do some political activism or something, I might say, and that as Dharma, but maybe some people that will be their expression of non-separation, but then other people would be like, we should just talk about doing artwork or something as an expression, creative art, and that will be their expression. So rather than talking about all those different ways it could be expressed, this is the big space, and then may everybody find their own unique way to express that.
Because like you were kind of the way you started was like, well, none of us, everyone agrees that we're experiencing, right? And so that is kind of a great equalizing field that like, okay, we all
got this.
That's
the ultimate
right?
Equalizing.
So
yeah.
So we're not different.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of like, if you start with precepts or something, different cultures react to things differently, and you know, mm-hmm. And even within Buddhism, it's changed within different sectors, and
yeah.
So that's not really equal anymore.
I think
right?
I like
it's
that.
It's kind of hard, and then you start a debate and all these things. So this is kind of nice, and fresh, and in some ways.
It's equalizing.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah.
Inclusive.
Yeah. It's starting with unity, mm-hmm. And then from that diversity can arise. We usually. Would agree that there's like 30 of us, 30 like minds residing in one zendo. But this perspective is there's like one mind in which 30 zendos are residing. Yeah. So there's this unifying, ungraspable mind, and then each of our 30 zendos, when we leave the zendo, we can. Some of us will be in the woods, and some will be in the city, and but those will all be this shared unity. And right now, it's so nice that instead of 30 different cities, we at least have 30 different zendos. That's also kind of intimate. But 30 different zendos is not nearly as intimate as the one mind that they're all appearing in. That's really intimate. And that one, when we start going our different ways, that one, that intimacy won't be lost, even if we never see each other again. Yes. While we're talking, I wonder if we could start collecting teacups.
I couldn't help but start thinking almost like imaginatively that we're future mind looking at past mind. What is the present? And that kept kind of arising for me.
We are future mind looking at past mind.
And what is the present?
What about we are just present mind looking at past and future mind?
Yeah, all of that.
That's how I would say it is there really, there is no past and future, and there never has been, and there never will be. There has only ever been now.
For some reason, asking that question, suddenly, like, Dogen wasn't writing this in the past, suddenly, for me.
No, he couldn't have if there wasn't any.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And suddenly,
Dogen didn't write this in the past.
Yeah.
And it will never be commented on in the future.
And you're speaking from the absolute.
Yeah. I like to. Yes.
So it made me think that you know, there's a lot of suffering going on in say Syria right now, and today I've had a great day, you know, removing cobwebs here at Jikoji. But when if I really believe that, if I'm really confident that I'm not 10,000 miles away, that there's no 10,000 miles, then even right now, my perspective is different on how Syria and myself might refresh each other.
Yeah.
So, if you know, if that were our perspective, like in a big way, of course things would unroll very differently.
Yeah. If more people could take up such a perspective, it would be almost impossible to harm anyone ever, actually, if we really see that we're not separate. So, and we might still say, but what about Syria? I mean, do you feel like you would kind of relate to the country of Syria differently from that perspective?
Yeah.
Like, in what way?
Well, that in terms of what we all do about these huge things, like environment or wars 10,000 miles away. Mm-hmm. We all try to do our best and recycle and write letters and but all from the perspective of there's distance and there's and there's safety here. We might say, well, for instance, I've seen Syria on the screen. How can anybody live there? Of course, we have to invite Syrians to come right here to Jikoji or to come right to Santa Cruz, because it looks like a pile of rubble in the desert there. And maybe I can really get active in immigration laws, just so that people have shelter over there.
Yeah, that's a nice example of, like, we don't want to exclude anyone. And it gets very complicated when you get into the nitty-gritty details of, well, if 30,000 Syrians suddenly arrived in Santa Cruz on the same day, would that actually be helpful? It gets tricky when we get into the details, but the spirit of, we start with, be like, we all share this one reality.
Our motivation and our intention, mm-hmm. in a big way would be very different.
Yeah.
We wouldn't say, well, you know, Europe is closer. They can handle the Syrians, and we'll handle the Hondurans.
Yeah.
But if there's no distance, no time and space, then the whole world is just compassion.
Yeah, yeah. Which can sound kind of idealistic, but in fact, there's a truth to it. And maybe if also from our personal point of view, we could say, what is it that, or from kind of the other side, what is it that prevents this flourishing of compassion? It's usually like a kind of the sense of me being this located body and individual consciousness that has to defend itself against everything outside itself. You could say that can start to loosen up, and our sense of like, but it would be so inconvenient to have all these Syrians living in my backyard or something. Would be like, well, what is this sense of convenience for me? And like, you know, sometimes I think of, the Bodhisattva thing, if you take it to its full extent, I feel like it's actually, if I start meditating on the full extent of what could be possible for the Bodhisattva, if we're really all equal, and we're all equal worth, not only humans, but all sentient beings, it gets frightening. I feel like if I'm in the perspective of the conventional independent self, it gets frightening because it's like, if somebody needs a heart transplant and I have a fresh, nice heart, why, even just some stranger, why shouldn't I give it to them? You know, if we're truly equal, right? It's scary, but I feel like a Bodhisattva, like, completely realized Bodhisattva might be, if they felt like that would be benefit the whole, they might be willing to do that. There's stories of the Buddha's past lives like this, right? But so the implications of this unity thing, if we take it all the way, I confess, like, it scares me. It scares me that Kokyo. But, you know, we're making steps in this direction. Before we give away our heart, we can maybe give away a few dollars to a stranger on the street. A kidney. Yeah, one kidney. Did anybody ever see this movie, 7 Pounds?
Yeah.
Somebody saw?
Yeah.
Yeah, intense, huh?
Yeah.
I thought maybe we should do this as a Zen Center movie night. Somebody basically does give away all his organs. It's viscerally disturbing to watch, but it's like, I feel like it's a Bodhisattva. It's one possibility for Bodhisattvas. Yes.
I would also suggest perhaps we could turn it around and thinking that the peace that we generate by cleaning the cobwebs at Jokoji is part of sending that peace. If we can't have that peace here, there's no way to have it in Syria. So start here.
Yeah, we start here.
Thinking the dedication that we do in the morning of service, you know, for peace in the Sangha.
Mm-hmm.
Do it here because you can do something about where you are. You can't, it's all theoretical.
We'll bring some oligarchs and gun sales people here and have a retreat with them.
Nice.
Inclusive.
Inclusive.
Ginzo ENRA.
Some Ginzo ENRA.
So, yeah, that's what, like I was saying this morning, was it, of like, Bodhisattva's first job is to start where we are, even ourself, actually, to start with our own contentment and let it spread from there. We definitely, you know, talking about giving away organs and stuff, if we would never, Bodhisattvas who give away organs would not, it would not be a good thing if they didn't do it joyfully. So whatever we do, it should be joyful. We shouldn't force ourselves to do anything not joyful. And that joy is in accord with reality, and that itself spreads too. Yeah. Yes?
Just like earlier you were saying that an important thing of teaching the Dharma is teaching people how to find contentment within themselves.
Yeah. So, which starts with contentment within ourselves.
Yeah, we'll start there and then move yes. forward. So as a bodhisattva, you would, my idea would be you would want to teach other people who are struggling how to deal with those struggles and find contentment, which might not necessarily mean you giving everything to them. You need, sometimes with children, for instance, the best way you can help them is by not helping them so they can learn to do it themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yes.
So, as far as giving away organs, seems to me it's not like a linear decision or a decision that you're going to have to. It's the whole thing.
Yes.
Impelling.
Yes.
Action.
Mm-hmm.
Or agent for that action.
Mm-hmm.
To do something.
Yeah.
Something like you cannot not do.
Yeah, I think that's a nicely put, yeah.
Yeah, that involves the whole
environment. It's not a decision made by the separate individual self. Mm-hmm. Which in fact no decision really is. And therefore we don't really have to worry about if we're gonna give away organs or not. Because I don't make that decision. Yeah.
That seems to align with also, like, sometimes you hear people who do heroic acts,
mm-hmm.
and ask them, like, why they did it, they're like, I don't know.
They often
don't know why they actually did it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, they become the agent. Somehow they got in touch and do it.
Like, if you ask all these people, why are you, like, spending your weekend just, like, sitting in this room and talking about weird stuff? It's like, a lot of people might say, I don't really know. I can come up with stories, but it's very mysterious. Suzuki Roshi says, it's wisdom that's seeking wisdom, not delusion seeking wisdom. So, to finish this, Dogen says, after the story where nobody could answer, that we've covered all the answers now, but Dogen says, what a pity. Dushan and the old woman's discussion on past mind and future mind has not been grasped by future mind, which is, I'm not sure quite what he's getting at there, but maybe it's something about how this Zen gets transmitted into the future. Not quite sure exactly what, but why he's emphasizing future mind. It's like,
I'm talking about, because the next line it says, Dishan does not seem to have acquired clarity even after that. So I'm wondering if you're referring to even Dishan's insight later, the painted rice cake does not satisfy hunger. He's even, I was wondering if he is just dismissing that.
Yeah, maybe what he's doing is saying even Dushan's future was not that clear. I think Dogen is being kind of critical of Dushan in general here. And I think there's some kind of sectarian stuff going on around here. They're trying to establish these new Zen lineages in Japan, and Dushan is not part of Dogen's lineage, and Rinzai style is kind of coarse, and Dushan is maybe most famous for doing a lot of shouting and hitting, That's his style. He's kind of coarse, and that's what it says, right? Dushan does not seem to have acquired clarity even after that. His actions were only coarse, or one translation says, violent. He was, and I think Dogen's critical of that part, that aspect of Dogen, of Dushan. As he studied with Lungtan for a long time, he must have had occasion to break Lungtan's head horn. The translator says, surpass the teacher. But we could, another translation says, to break his own head horn. Like, so maybe Dushan has a kind of demon horn or something that he can't break off. So I don't know, it's some Zen phrase. And to receive the pearl from the gill of the dragon, or the, receive the pearl from under the chin of the dragon. And so now this story of meeting with Dushan, meeting with Lungtan to finish the story after Dushan couldn't answer the woman selling rice cakes. He maybe felt kind of humbled, which helped him meet Lungtan. So he finally did arrive at Lungtan, and who coincidentally, it said that, who said that, did you say that, that maybe Lungtan sent the old woman out? Mm-hmm. So this is maybe that did happen, because apparently Lungtan's family was like generations of mochi sellers. Yeah, we know that about him historically, so I think he might be onto something. But arriving in the Dharma Hall, Dushan still somewhat arrogantly says, long have I heard of Lungtan, which means dragon marsh in Chinese. But arriving here, I don't see any marsh, nor do I see any dragon. And Lungtan says, now you have seen dragon marsh. So they're playing with like the emptiness language, right? I don't see any dragon or marsh. And Lungtan says, that's dragon marsh. In other words, not seeing dragon or marsh is seeing dragon marsh. Dushan said nothing again, but remained there and had some conversations with Lungtan. And one evening, as Dushan visited Lungtan in his room, Lungtan said, it's getting late, why don't you go now? And Dushan said goodbye and started to leave. But as he stepped out the door, it was pitch black. And he turned back to Lungtan and said, it's dark out here. And Lungtan said, well then, here, let me give you a light. And he lit a paper candle and gave it to Dushan. And as soon as Dushan reached out to take it, Lungtan blew it out. At that moment, Dushan experienced great enlightenment. And he bowed deeply. So it's a nice story for Dushan, for Dushan's awakening, that he was all into like illuminating the words of the Diamond Sutra, and I'm scared of the dark. Actually, it's dark out there. Can you give me some more light? Our conversation's been great. How about some light to go home by? Okay, here's some light. But as soon as you take it, it's gone. It's utter darkness. Of course, that's what all those commentaries are teaching. Is there's nothing to see. Mind is ungraspable. But in the utter darkness, with his light blown out, he experienced great awakening, it says here. And I think a lot of these stories we were talking about conceptual understanding, momentary experience of direct non-duality, and then realization of the extension and pervasion of this truth. And maybe a lot of these Zen stories are about momentary experiences. They call great enlightenment, but they're just momentary. And so Dogen now says, this Dushan does not seem to have acquired clarity even after he met Lungtan. His actions were coarse. As he studied with Lungtan for a long time, he must have had the occasion to break this horn and to receive the jewel from under the dragon's chin. But he only blew out a candle and was short of transmission of the lamp. So it's referring to this story. Really, I think it's better to say, as another translation, he had his candle blown out and therefore was short of the transmission of the lamp. So it's kind of a word play, right? Dogen's kind of being kind of critical. His candle was actually blown out. We say great enlightenment, but accordingly, monks who study the way should always make a diligent effort. Those who take an easy path are not adequate. Those who make a diligent effort are Buddhas and ancestors. Here it says, the inexhaustibility of mind, but actually it's just the same characters for the ungraspability of mind. So the ungraspable mind is to buy a piece of painted rice cake and chew it up in a single bite. So, as I mentioned before, Dogen has a whole essay called Painting of a Rice Cake that where he talks about it in this positive way. The story sounds a negative thing, right? A painted rice cake doesn't satisfy hunger. But in Dogen's essay, he says, the coming and going of birth and death is a painting. The painting is also like the movie on the screen, right? But also unsurpassed enlightenment is a painting. The entire universe and the open sky are nothing but a painting. In other words, everything we're experiencing is nothing but like the movie, but the actual nature of the movie is a screen. So it's okay that everything is a movie because it's really a screen, right? That's how I would understand why a painting of a rice cake actually does satisfy hunger.
It's no different.
There's no different, yeah. There's no rice cakes other than painted rice cakes. There's no rice cakes other than the ones appearing in the movie. So Dogen says, since this is so, there's no remedy for satisfying hunger other than a painted rice cake. Without painted hunger, you never become a true person. There's no understanding other than painted satisfaction. In fact, satisfying hunger, satisfying beyond hunger, not satisfying hunger, and not satisfying beyond hunger cannot be attained or spoken of without painted hunger. For now, study all of these as a painted rice cake. So Dogen's final word here is, ungraspable mind is to buy a piece of painted rice cake and chew it up in a single bite. This was presented to the assembly at Kanandori Kosho Horinji in Uji County, Yamashiro Province, in the summer practice period in the second year of the Ninji era in 1241.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.